This episode is sponsored by Cards Against Humanity, the company that brought land on the U.S.-Mexico border to stop Trump's wall, sued Elon Musk for $15 million for trespassing on that land, used profits from red states to fund abortion access, and paid people to give a shit about the 2024 election. Cards Against Humanity is one of the only companies stupid enough to stand up to Donald Trump. They don't profit from their political stunts, so if you want them to be able to afford a good lawyer, consider buying one of their new games, like Cards Against Humanity Tales, a book of fill-in-the-blank stories for horrible people, or Shit List, a new way to play the game where you write the answers, or Party Mouth, a new party game about shouting obscenities as a coping mechanism for the hellscape we live in. You listen to Cricket Media, so you're probably smart enough to figure out how to buy their stuff. Anyway, Cards Against Humanity apologizes for interrupting your podcast with their bullshit. Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Pod Save the People. It is the last month of 2025. This really has gone by crazily quickly. It's me, Miles, and Sharonda back to talk about the underreported news with regard to race, justice, and equity. And don't forget to follow our Instagram at Pod Save the People. Here we go. Another week where the country is still standing barely. This is DeRay at DRY on Twitter.
This is Miles E. Johnson at Feral Rapture on Instagram.
And this is Sharonda Bossier at Bossier Shay on Instagram and at Bossier S on Spill.
So this is super random, but I wanted to say it because she is a hometown hero. But do y'all remember Dominique Dawes?
Oh, yeah, of course.
What a great gymnast. But Dominique Dawes is about to open up a gym in Silver Spring, Maryland in mid-February. And Dominique Dawes was the first Olympian that I actually sort of like had any affinity for as a kid. Because she's from the Baltimore region. And I don't have anything deep to say about it besides like, don't forget Dominique Dawes. You know, people know Simone and they know all the young women today, but Dominique Dawes. And do you remember when she had that Tommy Hilfiger collab? It was just epic. I'm like, Dominique Dawes was that girl.
Shout out to her.
Yeah, glad to hear her name back in the news. Yeah, and doing something back at home because I think a lot of people hit, you know, international fame and like don't ever return home. So shout out to that too.
I'm Dominique. And that was the only positive news I have because, you know, the piece of news that I missed was the National Guard members getting shot in D.C. I missed it. I didn't get an alert about it. I don't know. I completely missed this. And it looks like one of the National Guard's people has since passed. Did you all see this in real time? Like, I just missed this story. I mean, it's very sad they got shot. Why is the National Guard still out in the street in D.C.? It makes no sense. But I'd love to know what you all have to say about it because I missed this one.
Yeah, I saw it unfolding in real time. And I think the thing that, you know, I'm most concerned about is that the accused shooter is someone who apparently worked with the CIA in Afghanistan and immigrated here as part of, you know, the process of bringing people who had supported the U.S. and its efforts in Afghanistan. And in a moment when the current administration is subjecting every immigrant, whatever pathway they availed themselves of to get here, to additional scrutiny and is threatening to send those people home, I'm deeply concerned about what this means for people who are from that part of the world and people who immigrated to the U.S. even after risking their lives to help advance U.S. goals abroad.
Yeah, definitely bad timing. If there was ever a good time to, you know, yeah, commit domestic terrorism. But I think also it's just about how these moments are just engineered to do conservative political lifting. And from my perspective, there is not too much of a gap between what he did and what we are seeing, what we saw earlier this year and last year and probably the year before that. But you see these army men doing, setting themselves on fire, blowing up cars when they were blowing up the Elon trucks, the cyber trucks and stuff. And I think that there's something to these young men going into the cult of the army and then feeling a range of guilt, feeling a range of different political illumination. And because they're already trained to kill and devastate, they find it easy to do the same thing where they're supposed to be either free or to their ally once they're I don't even want to say once they have political enlightenment, but once their maybe political worldview expands or gets crooked, and that's what this kind of feels like. It feels like, just like those other cases, like somebody who is trying to like almost like write something that they feel like was wrong. Like that feels like a common like narrative inside of these domestic terrorism cases around service people, is that they are trying to even the balance of what they did while enlisted.
I do appreciate that the public conversation seems to very quickly sort of understand how Trump exploits these things to make macro statements and moments. Whereas before, I think that people fed into it. I felt like more, whereas now people are like, okay, Trump, like this is not a reason to make this claim or to do this thing. So that is good. But back to Trump is, do you remember the Trump phone that was announced in June? It was a $500 phone. The plan was 47 something a month because he's the 47th president. It came with all these features and people were promised the phone in October. There is no phone. There is no update on when the phone is coming out. And it was a gold phone because, you know, Trump is all into gold things. But what a grift. He's so good at grifting people. You're like, why would you ever buy a Trump phone on a Trump mobile network, which you know doesn't, this is not a real thing.
Yeah, I don't think people know it wasn't a real thing. Yeah, I think, what I've been sitting in specifically, I don't know what it was about this Thanksgiving weekend. It was a good Thanksgiving week. But I was like, wow, most people are really idiots. Like that's where we're at. And I think I've always thought about it in the back of my mind. But I think just really sitting in it, I'm like, oh wow, you can really be a shiesty scammer from Queens. And if you just stick with it, you can just keep on hitting licks and hitting licks and hitting licks and hitting licks. Just get a cricket if you want to go cheaper.
Yeah, I think similar to Miles, a lot of people probably didn't realize that it was a scam. Probably thought he was branding some government initiative after himself, right? And assumed that he had access to the, like, you know, manufacturing capacity to like make it happen. I also think that there are people who feel like they want their name to be on the rolls of Trump supporters, however they have the capacity or access to do that. And so for some people that might be buying a ticket to a White House event, but for other people it's like, I might lose this $500, but I want the president to know, should I ever need him to know my name, right, that I supported something he did, because they're seeing how it pays off for people. And I think there's this sense that like we're all on some sort of watch list. And if we're racking up points, I want most of the points that I rack up to be in the pro-Trump column, however that is accessible to me. And most of that and most of the pathways to that are financial.
Those people are getting deported too. That's an interesting thing. Miles, what were you saying? Because that's what some other groups thought too, and he rounded up people up.
That is really interesting. When you were talking, it just reminded me of the text messages that I would get from the Democratic Party, and then because I don't respond to those, they turned into Trump messages. And just how I think so many of those moments, to your point, I think so many of those moments of selling product is to really, I'm going to go into conspiratorial land a little bit, but like, yeah, it does seem like data analysis. It does feel like that. It does feel like somebody's counting and seeing which citizens, what areas support. It will be interesting to see, let's say, for instance, if these phones sold more in, I don't know, let's be stereotypical, Tennessee. It will be interesting to see if there were things that happen there, because now you see there are people who are willing to support with money for products. Does it make sense? Like, I wonder how they're going to build on top of that.
And we don't know how many of the phones were sold. We just know that he did sell them, and the phones don't exist because Trump is a scammer. But did you see the Zohran and Trump conversation that happened? Fascinating. Remember, Zohran requested the meeting. It happened. People thought that Trump was going to chew him up, or it was, you know, Trump has played everybody else who's gone to the White House. And it seems, you know, it was a very different outcome than what people thought. Now, people have had a million takes. People are like, this is the setup. Trump is playing him cool because if Trump respects anything, he understands that like who the media listens to is the news. And he even sort of said it, like, he's like, I had the president of da-da-da here and they didn't care, but Zohran came and everybody paid attention. So he understands celebrity if he understands nothing else. So some people are like, well, he knew to play the cards right because this guy is just so popular and can be a real foil to him. Other people said that it allowed Trump to do what even the Democrats would not do, which is embrace Zohran. So Schumer did not do it. Jeffries did not do it. And then you get the president of the United States saying the most positive thing that we've heard an elected official say that was not an early supporter like AOC or Bernie, which is sort of an awkward position. And then you get Zohran saying, we agree about a lot of things. And, you know, Zohran brilliantly was like, for all the Trump supporters in New York City who voted for him, like, da-da-da-da, like, that was, I was like, that's a slick line, that's a good line. So, you know, I'm interested in what you all think about how the meeting went. Do you think this was a setup? Do you think Trump actually respects him? It definitely threw off the right. People were thinking that they were going to leave the meeting and bash him and with Trump's full support. And then all of a sudden, Trump did not say anything. But, you know, that interesting moment where they're like, do you think Trump is still a fascist? And Zohran just, you know, starts to talk. And Trump's like, oh, yeah, tell him I'm a fascist. It's okay.
I don't care.
And yeah, he's like, oh, it doesn't matter to me. And, you know, Zohran's press afterwards, people have asked him. And Zohran's like, everything I said about him, I believe. You know, like, so what do you all make of this?
I had first heard about the meeting reported on, I listened to a lot of news. And so I needed to actually go back and see the visuals because I was like, I know that did not happen how these people said it happened. And it did. Like Trump is looking at him like glowingly, like there's a sparkle in his eye. And I do think that probably above all else, Trump is trying to figure out how to capture some of that momentum, some of that popularity, because his shine is fading. And there's no one else really who has it in that moment. I mean, even people who lived outside of New York were people who were like super excited about what this campaign represented, what his election represented. And I think the closest that we've had to that feeling on the left is sort of encapsulated in Mamdani. And so I think Trump is like fascinated by that feeling, that spirit, that energy, that momentum. He wants to be proximate to it. And I sometimes am still trying to figure out if Trump believes the things that he says or if he's just like, these are the things that help keep me in the spotlight and in power. In some ways, he feels like a vessel that if the left had gotten to, he might have also been movable on some of those things too, right? Like, I don't know what his real compass and North Star are other than enriching himself. And he was willing to take whatever pathway he needed to get there. And like being proximate to Mamdani is like, oh, I can, again, remain in the spotlight, you know, stand in some of that glow, some of that shine, and continue to do the thing, which is pretend to be an outsider of, you know, political power and the political establishment by embracing this man.
To your point, the left, or like the neoliberal left, definitely embraced Trump. That's how come Trump exists with, you know, with the NBC show and stuff like that. And I think that's why he gagged so many people. Even post the Exonerated Five and like kind of all these kind of like white supremacist moments he had, he was really existing specifically in the early 2000s as a liberal figure, kind of absorbed into that kind of liberal mainstream nothingness that like, you know, but you kind of think, oh, he doesn't have a problem with gay people. Oh, he likes blacks or whatever. Blacks used on purpose.
yeah.
I think in order to be Trump, in order to be in the positions, you have to kind of not believe anything. You have to be okay with being like an empty vessel and have a consistent belief in power and be able to shift things. And I think that's how come he has a weird coalition of people because he kind of like believes it, but he doesn't believe it. And that's he gives just enough to people. But as far as Zohran, I thought it was really masterful. And speaking of like sociopaths, I think that you kind of need a little bit of that. And I think Zohran has that. Like when I see him smiling at everything and how he kind of flips sentences and his ability to be in certain rooms, I just think that like, oh yeah, he definitely has that kind of like American psycho, American sociopath element that I think you need in order to be good at politics, especially today. But I am wondering how long these kind of little neoliberal concessions that you have to make in order to do well, I'm wondering how long that is going to happen until he has like a backlash. Like, I'm curious about like what he's going to do once maybe the people who really liked him, who are just like really to the left of him, are kind of over the playing nice and or the over these kind of like not firing the Zionists, not maybe walking back things that he said about Netanyahu. I'm wondering how long until that kind of implodes on him, and then what he's going to do next. But he is creating an interesting coalition. And to me, that unique coalition is because the Democrats' failure to endorse him. So he's actually able to create this weird pathway that I think we just haven't seen. So I'm curious as to where it's going to land.
And what happened, you know, who will sabotage him or work alongside him? Because as much power as the mayor of New York City has, he does not have absolute power. And the woman who was really progressive is not going to win to be the next speaker of the New York City Council. There's a more moderate Democrat who has won that. And she is not fully on board with everything Zohran has said. So, like, that'll be interesting. And with the free daycare, the childcare stuff, all that, they will have to pass some sort of tax to make it happen. And he will need the governor to do that. So trying to figure out how he like threads this needle, and even the rent freeze, you know, it looks like Adams on his final days is going to try and appoint his people to be on the rent guideline board to be there for all of Zohran's tenure, because the majority of voting members of the rent board are by the mayor. Adams is trying to do a runaround so Zohran won't be able to put his people on it. So, you know, when Zohran says he's going to do a rent freeze, people won't, I'm worried that people won't have sympathy. Like, oh, you actually just didn't get what every other mayor got, which is to put all your people on it. You will be stuck with the Adams people. So you really might not get a rent freeze because your people won't be on it. So I'm hoping that he's not sabotaged to death, but I like Zohran and we'll see.
I think I maybe said this the last podcast too, but I do also think because of how he did his digital media campaign and how where his connection is, and I know that it's like not typical or like the right thing to do, quote unquote, but I do think if he's getting complications because of a moderate conservative politicians or government, I think that he should tell on them. I think he needs to be a tattletale. I think he needs to be a tattletale. I think he's in a unique position because of his ability to show that he can build coalitions, because of his ability to show that he can work across lines to say, you know, this is not happening, or this is happening slower, or this is not happening at the maximum that we want and that I promised, because these people are corporatist Democrats and they need to make the spot hot for them. We see that the Republicans are retiring, and I'm not saying they retiring because they getting death threats. So I ain't saying that, but I'm saying we can make it hot. So I think if he makes it hot and is transparent around things, I think that can help things too.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, let me tell you, it has been cool. I traveled for Thanksgiving this year, but still had a Friendsgiving. And like, just how cool was that? Like, it was cool to be in a different country and still celebrate bringing everybody together. But sometimes when you bring people together, it's a lot going on. You need time to process it, especially when you're around your family and also around your friends. And that is where therapy comes in, is that you don't have to process the world around you alone. One of the cool things about BetterHelp is that you can find a therapist that works for you. You can get matched really quickly. There are a ton of therapists, over 30,000 therapists available, and it's the world's largest online therapy platform. They serve over 5 million people globally. And here's the thing. If you get matched with somebody, it's not a good fit and you want to change them, you can switch anytime. It's an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. And there's a matching process, so it works. And I'll tell you, therapy for me has been powerful because I used to process the world with all the people in my life around me, but I needed to talk about them sometimes. And it's cool to have a therapist so that I can talk to somebody who's just not in my day-to-day life. This December, I start a new tradition by taking care of you. Our listeners get 10% off at betterhelp.com/people. That's betterhelp.com/people. I remember when we talked about white supremacy a decade ago, it was sort of like, okay, you're being a little dramatic with your language, and I know racism is bad. That was sort of like the tone people had when we said things like white supremacy or white nationalist, or like, it was like, okay, we hear you, but like, that's a little dramatic. I got on Twitter today, and I'm seeing some people being like, this white nationalist rhetoric. I'm like, okay. okay, this is interesting. Like, people are, it was around the green card thing. I remember how fraught these conversations around race were. Like, people just thought we were crazy for being like, no, I think the strategy is like, like, get rid of everybody not white. People were like, you're being dramatic. And people now are like, oh no, that is the strategy. And I appreciate how hard everybody worked to normalize the reality of that. I don't know if you have anything to say about that, but I've seen it. And I am like, thank God we moved that needle.
Shout out to Bell Hooks, right? Because we talk a lot about intersectionality. We talk a lot about those type of things and a lot of those words. And she critiqued those words while she was living. A lot of those take out the thunder of what we're dealing with. It can often kind of go into the marketplace of ideas as not that bad. But when she says white supremacist, imperialist, patriarchy, you have to deal with each component of it in a way that these other words don't do it. My only thing about it, and you know how I feel about slowness and incrementalism, and 10 years ago, you saying I'm crazy, and now you have illumination. Now it's too late. Now you have Nick Fuentes, and you have a whole lot of people. Shout out to the Glory Purse movement. That's not a real shout out. But like, but when we talk about Nick Fuentes and the Glory Purse movement, now, even though you're saying, oh, this is a white nationalist thing, now you have a whole cohort of people on the right who are like, yeah, we call ourselves that. We're white nationalists. And now he's we have a group of white supremacists who are so okay with certain languages that used to be able to separate us. And now it's a part of the atmosphere, you know? It's like, yeah, I'm a white nationalist. I don't know if y'all got to see the video of Nick Fuentes that or any video of Nick Fuentes, but I think he's really interesting because of that, because he's using terms like white nationalism and saying, you know, everybody's playing identity politics. And now, because everybody's playing identity politics, white people need to play identity politics. And just like those Jewish people have Israel, we have America, and it's okay. And so now that language that you waited 10 years to be right about, 10 years to catch up to, 10 years to be educated on, now it's too late because it's already been absorbed into our politics. And now, you know, we're probably going to have our first white nationalist president soon.
Soon? I thought we already had one. But is,
I know,
is,
I
is like, also...
soon. You know, is that a joke, Miles? You think Miles, is, that he's a fair-weather president?
Not even just that. I think that there's a lot of dancing around that Trump has to do, even to this day, even with how evil he is. And I think that we're going to a point where there's not going to be no dancing around. It's just going to be the horror of somebody saying, I'm not playing this game that y'all played. People like Nick Fuentes, there's another group of conservatives who think that Trump is, just how I feel like neoliberals and Democratic politicians are going too soft and not doing enough. There is another wing of people who feel the same thing. And now they're coming into power now that Trump is kind of dissolving.
Is part of your point, too, that you feel like those folks embracing the term white nationalist, white nationalism is also defanging the term a little bit? Like, what does it mean for someone to embrace it? Like, does it sort of decrease the power of the term to convey the real, to use your other term, horror of what they believe and want to enact?
I think all language, once you speak it specifically inside of these social media spaces and give it to marketplace, I think all of it's defanging. I think we see that with feminisms. We see that with black feminisms. We see that with so many different things. So yes, I do think that's happened. To answer your question, yes, I do think part of it is that it defangs it. But I think the other part of it is just the fact that we have a new group of white supremacists who were already looking for opportunity for those languages not to be weaponized to them. And they have been looking for ways to say, yeah, you're not going to scare me with that. You're not going to call me a fascist or a Nazi, and that's going to shut me up. So I'm actually going to embrace some of this language so you can't shut me up because I already called myself that. So what's next? Because, yeah, I'm a white nationalist, and now I'm going to put this into policy, or I'm going to galvanize people behind it. And we're not ashamed of that because we don't feel like that is a bad word anymore.
That's interesting. That's like the flip side. I still think it is important that our side is using it and like acknowledge it, like people who weren't using it. And shout out to Bell Hooks, because I remember reading Bell Hooks in college and I was like, this feels like a lot, Bell. I'm like, white supremacist, capitalist, da, da, da. And now I'm like, maybe you should have added a couple more words, Bell, and I know better. but Miles, I hadn't thought about that side of it. Like, what happens when people sort of make it a challenge now? They're like, yeah, I got that. Like, this is who I am. And, you know, the next thing is going to be.
So just to put a button on what I was thinking. So I think the next thing, now that you are okay with white nationalists, I think that these white male podcasters who are okay with using the ones in the air, I think the next journey up is to actually use the full language. So don't just take the black feminist rhetoric when it's really comfortable. Now be a futurist and say, you know what I need to say right now? I need to say white supremacist, capitalist, patriarchy, imperialism. I need to actually map out these words today and start getting people comfortable with them so we can actually examine them and talk about them and name these things and not wait for them to be co-opted into something that is defanged and be able to use for pure evil. You know?
Well, that goes into what I said all this to lead into the conversation about green cards. Trump made this statement that he's going to re-examine green cards in 19 countries, but the real takeaway is re-examine citizenship status, is that what he's talking about is the process of denaturalization, and to denaturalize somebody is to remove their citizenship status after they've already gained citizenship. It is a necessarily and importantly hard process to undergo. To do. And what he is signaling is that he will make it an easier process to undergo. He's also signaled to the embassies in those 19 countries to stop issuing the documentation to make it easier for people to go through the green card process. And he said, he was like, the Biden people let in 20 million people do the green card thing, and they just did it sloppily, and we're going to clamp down on it. So I don't want people to miss that that what he's talking about is denaturalization, and the process of removing people's citizenship status who were not born in the country is what he's trying to do, which is crazy. But I wanted to bring it here.
Yeah, I mean, my best friend is married to a naturalized citizen, and they have two kids, and we've been having a conversation, and she's just like, I want you to know, like, if he's denaturalized, if he's deported, we're going back with him. And there's a whole bunch of like political and policy things I could say, right? But like, this woman has walked with me through life since I was 11 years old. And we're having very real conversations about her having to leave the country of her birth because she married and had children with someone who wasn't born here. I don't really have anything to say other than like, what the f***?
I really hope that like these kind of moments like wake people up, because like, I don't want to, like, every single time I'm on here talk about the Democratic Party, but it's just wild to me that, like, there's not better ways to, like, kind of create propaganda, and then you have, like, an opponent who just lies, and you have an opponent who just makes things up and creates content and creates things, and there's just no, there's just no attempt of painting the world that these white supremacists want. There's a lot of anti-Trump stuff, but there is a deeply xenophobic sentiment in America across race. And like, and that to me is what scares me. What's kind of scares me is that I do not see the care or the political concern around immigrants outside of the internet, like if I'm being real, or in very, very liberal spaces. And I know where I am, so I know that's easy to do, but I'm also around really normal Black people who are not necessarily deeply politicized, but they are political enough to have deeply xenophobic ideas.
So you're saying we haven't done enough to organize those people? We're not having propaganda to counter the crazy propaganda?
And, you know, I stay away from, like, the organizing languages, but I don't stay away from education languages. Like, there's not a connection of, like, you know what? Immigrants for Black people, and this is my experience, and from what I've studied and stuff, I see that immigrants being in America has helped soften the white supremacist blows that Black people hit, because immigrants hire Black people. Immigrants aren't always entrenched in the same type of Americanized anti-Blackness as everybody else. And we've been able to create coalitions. And if we have less and less people who are not white leaving this country or being, or there being hostility, or even if, so if you're in this country, you're scared, so you're not going to do anything, that makes Black Americans an easier target. And I feel like all of these things that Trump is doing, but also just what the Republican Party is doing in general, is to get these immigrants out, get these people out so then they can handle the original sin, which is free Black Americans. And once they're in a position to handle that original sin, it will be too late. And it makes me sad to hear Black Americans who are joined in the forces of xenophobia right now because of the job market, because they see Mexican Americans working more, or because they see immigrants getting job titles that are saved for Black people, but you're from Nigeria and where the Black American people, all that kind of stuff that is really economically fueled. It saddens me.
Though this growing sense among Black Americans that they were experiencing particularly acute anti-Black American sentiment at the hands of immigrants, right? Who, for a host of reasons we can all talk about, right, are likely to be the shop owners where we shop, right? Everything from like beauty supplies to swap meets, right? Or the owners of the nail salons where we get our nails done, et cetera, et cetera. And I do think that, to your point, Miles, while, you know, thinking of the enslavement of Black people as one of the U.S.'s original sins, one of the U.S.'s...
I didn't say that. To America, the white supremacist capitalist patriarchy, the freeing and integrating of Black Americans into American free society is the original sin.
Is the original sin. Like, yes. We should have never done that. We should have sent all y'all back to Liberia if we was gonna let y'all free, right?
Or never granted you full citizenship.
Right. I think my challenge there, though, and like the way that you sometimes have described the dynamic between, you know, U.S.-born Black Americans and other immigrant communities is like one of the U.S.'s chief exports is also anti-Blackness. So a lot of people engage with those ideas and internalize those ideas before they even meet Black Americans, right? And like come here, and then like the first thing is like, you can be whatever you want in this country. We work so hard to get you here. The only thing you can't be is like them. Right. And so I think like, yes, some of the things are economically motivated, but I think also some of them are just based off like the way people talk to us when we in the grocery store, you know? And I'm not making excuses. I'm just saying, like, I think part of the reason that organizing language is at least helpful to me is because it does get at hearts and minds in a way that sometimes educator language does not.
The question I have for every organizing activist is, could you do this in a community center? Like, could you land the argument? Could you win it? Could you sell it in a room of non-activists? Like, can you get people across the finish line in a room of people who don't identify as organizing activists? And I'd say in most rooms I'm in, it'd be hard. Like, you wouldn't be able to get them to from point A to point B. The other side is very good at getting people from point A to point B. It might be racist, crazy, bigoted, wrong, lying, but they can get you there. And I do, like, if I need no more work to do, but if I had another initiative, it would be like a comms division, just helping people like talk to aunts and uncles to get people from A to B, because they're right. Like, the analysis is right. The like, but you're, and I think you're right, Miles, when I think about the xenophobia and da-da-da. I think the people are movable, but I don't think we have the skills on our side. I struggle a little bit.
And just what I was saying earlier around the organizing languages, I was just saying that I don't want to use it because I'm not an organizer. So I don't want to tell people.
Yeah,
so I wasn't saying that I wasn't trying to like paint a picture that it wasn't useful. I just didn't want to get into that because I'm not an organizer or activist. It's a philosophical feeling journey that people need to go on that needs to be couched by education. But it's really, people need to understand that no matter what, utilizing and wielding fascism through your votes or through cultural sentiment is never a good idea. But people think it's a good idea. So people think, oh, I'm just going to get them. I'm just going to get this conservative person to take them out. Or I'm going to join in on this. Or I'm going to wear, even to me, you know, fashion, culture, those are all places of what you wear, what signs you got. Even in the gay community, it is very common to see people utilize and weaponize fascism and conservatism in our culture when we don't like somebody because of interpersonal ideas and things. So I get that those Jamaican people at your restaurant are rude and slow. Yes. I promise you, the way to correct it is not letting a white supremacist or white supremacist ideals or white supremacist culture find a home on your tongue, in your vote, or in your fashions. Like that, and I think those things can only be argued out through feelings and philosophy. It's not, because it's not rational.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. Pod Save the People is brought to you by Mosh. The older I get, the more thoughtful I am about what I put in my body, how I take care of my body. I exercise now in a way that I just never did. It's been like a 3-year journey. I just am so much more focused than I was before. And the old adage, you are what you eat, rings true for all of us. And that was something we learned growing up. But it's more true today, especially when I'm thinking about protein snacks. I didn't even understand anything about protein before I started going to the gym. But finding tasty protein is a little harder than you would think until you get to Mosh Bars. Mosh Bars are great. And Mosh, which you might have heard about on Shark Tank, it was founded by Maria Shriver and her son, Patrick Schwarzenegger, with a simple mission to create a conversation about brain health through food education and research. Now, Maria's father suffered from Alzheimer's, and since then, she and Patrick have dedicated themselves to finding new ways to help other families dealing with the debilitating disease. Mosh is the first and only food brand boosted with Cognizant, a premium nootropic that supplies the brain with a patented form of acetylcholine. Mosh bars also actually taste great and come in 9 mouth-watering flavors, including 3 new plant-based flavors, chocolate chip cookie, hazelnut chocolate chip, and peanut chocolate chip. But here's the best part, to make you feel good. Mosh donates a portion of all proceeds from your order to fund gender-based brain health research through the Women's Alzheimer's Movement. Now, why gender-based? 2/3 of all Alzheimer's patients are women. Mosh is working closely to close the gap between women and men's health research. Now, I eat my Mosh bar after the gym every day. It's great, tastes good. I'm a big fan of chocolate chip cookies. Love it. It's my favorite flavor of almost everything. And the cool thing is that some of these bars at other places, like, they don't always taste great. Mosh bars taste great. Can't recommend them more than I do already. They really are amazing. If you want to find out ways to give back to others and fuel your body and your brain, Mosh bars are the perfect choice for you. Head to moshlife.com/PSTP to save 20% off free shipping on the bestsellers trial pack or the new plant-based trial pack. That's 20% off plus free shipping on either the bestsellers trial pack or the plant-based trial pack at moshlife.com/PSTP. Thank you, Mosh, for sponsoring this episode.
I'm really fascinated by, like, can you land the argument in a community center? And, like, some of those things need to be argued out, because I had this experience last night at dinner with my best friend and her family and one of her other friends. And we were talking about all the reporting around flu season in Southern California is expected to be really bad this year. And one of her other friends owns and operates a daycare. And we started talking about, like, you know, what vaccine she requires for the kids and her staff and which one she doesn't. And then she proceeds to tell me about, like, the diffuser she uses and the eucalyptus oils and, like, the the citrus that the kids have to eat and all of this other stuff, right? All of this to, like, dance around a conversation of, like, are you getting the flu shot or nah, right? And and I raised that because, you know, my news this week is about a growing movement of people who are trying to move away from what they see as medical intervention. And we're seeing this movement happen on both the left and the right. And I know sort of the, like, the RFK anti-vaccine people have gotten a lot of airtime, but there's been a growing movement over nearly the last decade around what people are calling free birth. And it's really started by these two women who were both ex-doulas, who launched a podcast in 2017 to talk about what they call radical responsibility and free birth. And sort of the underlying ethos or sentiment is, quote, our bodies do not grow babies that we cannot birth. And it's a really popular movement. So they, you know, this reporter has a forensic accountant go through all of the publicly available financial data related to this podcast, its courses, its, you know, YouTube channel, et cetera. And they estimate that these two women have generated revenue exceeding $13 million since 2018, which is a lot of money, right? And they, this article details a couple of women who, again, for a host of reasons, do not trust traditional medicine in this country and are looking for something that they feel will make their birth easier and will ensure that they are not sent to a hospital or that they get unnecessary medical intervention. And has resulted in, unfortunately, like, some mothers experiencing loss. And I'm bringing it here because I want us to talk about this, I think, especially as a Black woman who has chosen not to give birth for a host of reasons, given what I know about Black maternal health outcomes in this country, reading this and watching these two white women, right, grow this movement of people who are so distrustful of medicine that they are actually putting themselves and their children at risks. Like, how do we talk about that, right? How do we say, like, yes, giving birth in this country is riskier than it should be for all of us? It's particularly risky for a certain subgroup of us, right? But like, the answer to that is not to forego expertise altogether. It is not to not have a doula. It is not to not have a midwife. It is not to have a hospital plan in the event that something should go wrong. And these people are scammers and they're scamming you, right? And so it's a really well-reported article. I hope that people who are listening actually take the time to read it. But again, I think it's raising for me some of the questions that we were just grappling with, which is like, there's the evidence-based argument around why this is a bad move. And then there is the work of actually getting people to understand and feel in their gut that we can and should reimagine birth in this country, but this is probably not the way to do it.
Shona, I just got to say, I feel like I've seen a lot of things. I feel like I see most things on Twitter. This blew my mind. I certainly didn't know people were foregoing medicine as like a trend. I definitely knew people didn't want like epidurals. I understand and get it. Da, da, da. I just had no clue. I also struggle when people call everything a movement now after the protest. It really bothers me, but whatever. But I didn't know there was this whole push to be like, just do it yourself. And when you're like, well, babies die, that makes total sense to me. I'm like, well, what did you think was going to happen? The only reason a whole set of babies are alive right now is because we have things like the NICU and we have modern medicine to treat things that were killing kids 100 years ago that were killing moms, tests that we couldn't figure out what was going on with your heart rate or your sugar, da-da-da.
Yeah.
So I think the most surprising thing for me, though, was the podcast. Like, my mind, there would be, like, a center that started this and people, like, I don't know. Like, that was, so when I started, I was like, okay, cool. I'm like, this is crazy. And then I'm like, not a podcast. It's convinced all these people. And I actually have a really good friend, young Black gay man who is an OBGYN. And we've talked a lot and he's like, DeRay, and this all makes sense. He's like, the stuff people come in having heard somewhere and they're like, literally telling me what I can and can't do. And he's like, I'm trying to save this baby. Like, I really, you got to like work with me on this. And they're like, no, I read this. I heard that, da, da, da. And he's like, I know, I get it. I'm with you. Like, I believe it too. But I really want to save this kid. And he's talked about the challenge that he's had to, and he's like, it's not even medical advice. It's not like another doctor told them. He's like, literally, they'll be like, I heard that if the baby's sideways, it's okay. And he's like, what is happening? And he's like, we actually do have a real problem in maternal health and this isn't helping it. And I was like, oh, well, he said that. But then when I read your article, I was like, oh, this is a bigger problem than I got. So I have no solutions here. I have nothing deep to say besides blew my mind. And, you know, forgetting bad, if you want to start a podcast, Lord knows you can chase people's lives for better or for worse, because that is nuts.
The one thing I want to say about the point of it being like not doctors is that these women, because they don't want to be sued, are smart enough to go to great pains to let you know that they're not medical professionals, right? They're like, we're not medical professionals, but based on our experience and the hundreds of children that we've helped birth. And there is something about trying to tap into the knowledge of women who came before us that I think is a good thing, right? But even like one of the women in the article, right, Emily Saldaya, that's not her birth name. We're not really clear how she came by that surname. And some of it feels like trying to signal a connection to a culture other than white American culture that she thinks will give her also some additional credibility in these spaces, right? Because we're also supposed to trust the quote unquote indigenous knowledge of the people who were here first. And I think she's trying to take advantage of some of that too.
There's so much here in the article. I think the first thing is it shows you how powerful intimate media is. It's the most powerful thing ever. So I think sometimes in a post-Oprah world, we get fascinated because Oprah was on the network, but and Oprah was on the big stage and she had the name. But the thing that made her so powerful was because she was an intimate person in your living room having conversations with you hourly. And now that we have the podcast marketplace, everybody can kind of create that. And that is more powerful than what institution you get verified for, what doctors, what you got there, the human mind and heart combination. it's tricky. And I think this is a good example of that. But I think it's just where we're at too. I think that you're so many people, because of where healthcare is, because of like kind of like the failure of Obamacare and now the gutting of Obamacare, like so many people are going to make those choices. When I was looking at the price range for some of these things, and I'm trying not to spill nobody's tea. I'm Hotep adjacent. So I know, and I'm Bohemian adjacent. So I know some people who have been quite clear of being like, listen, if I have to spend $500 or $1,000 on a premium, or $500 or $1,000 on these vitamins or this program or this person who I trust or this therapist or this spiritual thing that I trust, I'm here to make that choice. And I guess my thing is, because America manufactured poverty and made an industry out of health, I feel really bad for the women involved. I feel really bad for the children involved. And I also don't feel bad for the host like that, but I also understand the desperation of needing to find like a marketplace in order to get more money. Like we just create such desperate, absurd circumstances through capitalism that are not necessary. And if everybody just had healthcare, and if everybody just had, here I am being a propagandist, everybody just had basic income, all these absurd stories wouldn't feel so necessary to exist. But it just makes me sad that these tragic Jerry Springer stories are just the blossom of capitalism.
Yeah, and I'm not surprised that we see the distrust in lots of other spaces related to modern medicine, to be honest with you. I am surprised to see it in situations that are truly life and death. You know what I mean? Like, no one carries a pregnancy to term and doesn't want to do everything to ensure that that delivery goes smoothly. You know what I mean? So I know that a lot of these people are reaching out from a place of desperation and fear, right? But then it's like they're listening to these women who say things like, I don't believe in gravity, or I'm no longer quote unquote round earth committed. And I'm like, y'all got to find someone else. Like, that's the thing. It's like, the absurdity of like the other things that these people believe, you know? So there is a little bit of like a find your alternative pathway, but there are alternative pathways that are trained midwives, right? Who are trained to intervene, who aren't saying things like, you signed up for and believe in this philosophy of radical responsibility, and therefore I'm absolved of any responsibility to make sure that you have a smooth birth and that your child survives, you know?
Yeah. But to the beginning of this conversation, and I'm saying this as gently as possible with this word, but like idiot, like stupid, like not educated, easily manipulated. If you are somebody who is Machiavellian, or who has a gift of gab, or who has the gift of scam, this is a really fruitful era for you right now, because you have a fearful and ignorant population. And for us, people who are educated, those things are laughable and stuff, but to somebody else, it's not laughable. Or when you, and we kind of just assisted, not to totally tie it back into the Democratic Party, but it's like also like, okay, well, these people won't talk about the babies being blown up in Gaza, so how am I going to trust them? And then these people kill Black women, and then these people think that the earth might be flat, might be round, they're not committed. And to some people, it's all a little flat. And so, and when that's the marketplace of who to trust, I just mourn these choices that people have.
It also is interesting because you remember that you actually don't need a ton of people. You just need a couple people to help seed it. And then, you know, a thing becomes a thing becomes a thing. And this is how people think Tylenol caused autism, right? Like you actually don't need, we have been confused by how many people it takes for an idea to take hold. And this to me was my case study. I'm like, not this crazy podcast that I've never heard anybody mention about has killed people. That is crazy.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
Pod Save the People is brought to you by Blinds.com. You spent all that effort making your home feel like a winter wonderland, from stringing lights to decorating every corner and selling the perfect vibe. But if the old blinds are throwing it all off, it may be time to do something about them. With Blinds.com, you can upgrade your window treatments and pull the whole look together before the holidays hit full swing. Between holiday shopping, wrapping, decorating, and hosting, who has time for home projects? If your blinds are outdated or broken and you don't have time to tackle fixed windows on the to-do list, Blinds.com can help because they make it simple to refresh your space without the hassle. The holidays come fast. You're decorating, shopping, and trying to keep up. And somewhere in the middle of it, you realize those blinds can really use an upgrade. But it's time to deal with that. With Blinds.com, you don't have to. You can refresh your space online easily and affordably before the holidays are in full swing. I didn't have great blinds in my apartment until Blinds.com. Now, Blinds.com called out the window treatment industry for what it was: outdated, overpriced, and built to serve salespeople, not customers. So they flipped it. While others may overpromise or undercharge, Blinds.com delivers custom window treatments for your space, your way, at your convenience. And unlike some competitors, the price you see is the price you pay. No hidden fees, and there's zero pressure. Whether you want to do it yourself, let the pros handle it, or maybe something in between, Blinds.com gives you options so you're in control. Need help picking the right look? Blinds.com's experts are available on your schedule for free consultations. And if you want full white glove treatment, they can even schedule licensed, vetted pros to measure your windows at no cost, and they'll install everything for one low price. From blackout and motorized options to classic shutters, Blinds.com has window treatments for every room, every style, every budget, even shades for your outdoor space. And it's all backed by Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee, so you know you're covered, literally and figuratively, because at Blinds.com, the only thing they treat better than windows is you. The Black Friday deals at Blinds.com are going strong all month long, so don't miss your chance to save big. And as always, our listeners get $50 off when you spend $500 or more. Just use code PSTP at checkout. Limited time offer. Rules and restrictions apply. See Blinds.com for details.
Y'all, so I dug into my big black library of films and books and found a classic. It's called Chameleon Street. It's directed by Wendell B. Harris Jr., and it came out in 1990. So this is a film that predates, you know, you heard me say 1990. So this is a film that predates Catch Me If You Can, but it has a very similar storyline. But I want to tell you, the camera work, the cinematography, the avant-garde use of camera work is really good. So if you're a film geek, this is definitely the thing to go watch. And if you're a Black history or Black culture fanatic like I am, it's something to watch. But it's just so good, just first of all, as a film. But what made me interested in giving it to us as a news story is because the theme in the film is around this man who goes from different careers, scams himself into different careers, and kind of goes up the class ladder through these different lies and these different and these different scams. And in my head, after I was done watching the movie, I instantaneously connected it to the quarter zip trend. And you know, at first I was connecting the quarter zip trim to Paris is Burning, because I was thinking, well, here is the idea of realness showing up again. Here's the idea of Black men through tomfoolery and digital play showing that the only gap for real between me and respectability is performance. And me as a queer person, me as a RuPaul fan, you're born and everything else is drag. I really like that idea. Of course, it kind of stops. So I hate that from the conversation that I've seen, the quarter zip trend has become, oh, you're going from non-respectable to respectable, where I wish the conversation went, oh, wait, me as a person is a blank canvas and all of this performance and societal performance is fake, and I can don and move between whatever I want to go between. Like, I wish that that's what we were talking about. I wish that's where the conversation went, but it didn't. But either way, I wanted to bring this to the podcast because I thought, I wanted to bring this kind of like historical Black film that didn't get a lot of shine. This was his only feature film. He was actually, the director was kind of barred out of film because he was so good. People were threatened. So when you go and look at the New Yorker article that I got this news from, you'll see that he was kind of systemically like shut out of the film industry. But also, I just thought it was such a cool connective tissue of class performance and Black people thinking about it and examining it and telling stories about it. And I think that we're still doing that, even when we don't know it through TikTok trends and Instagram trends. We're still examining and talking about performance of self and respectability. Yeah, so I wanted to bring that to the podcast to, A, give y'all a new movie to watch, and then also hear your takes on the quarter zip trend, respectability, and the performances that we don in order to survive in this world.
I'm sort of like, who decided this was a trend? Like, what? At what point does it become a thing that people like, this is happening all across the country? I don't know. You know, shout out to Quarter Zip, but I'm a vest guy. And you know, shout out to a good vest. So.
You ain't never beating those Patagonia allegations.
Yeah. I have some great Quarter Zips. So like, shout out to the Quarter Zips. Like, they're a vibe, right? It made me think too of, do you remember, and Miles, we're not the same age, Sharonda, you definitely remember this. Do you remember when we wore formal clothes to go out to the club?
Yes. Or like just to, yes.
Like that was yes. like an era. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And this feels like the old is new again. Like that's what the quarters mm-hmm. it feels like to me. It's like it's the cooler version of when we used to wear ties and sweater vests and mm-hmm. dress slacks going out. You know what I mean? Like yeah. that was, what an era that was.
There was two Black dudes from New York who started the quarter zip trend as kind of like a joke and as a mocking of kind of like white financial district culture. And I was trying to get their names to put it in, and it just went into like a more serious thing. But I'm not that much younger than you. And when we were hitting the club, we were still
now
doing, we were doing business. I'm saying we were still doing business casual, but also we were in the recession. So again, this is a recession indicator. Black people, you think about when Classic Man came out and how that was on the edge of a kind of conservative wave after Obama. If you literally look at the trends of Black people, we actually always fold ourselves into some type of conservatism when things get conservative nationally. So I think this is just another iteration of that too.
Yeah, I think my immediate reaction to the quarter zip trend, I thought of a few things. I thought about like the late 90s adoption of like preppy clothes. So like Tommy Hilfiger, Nautica, right? Like Ralph Lauren as like what Black celebrities were adopting and wearing, even if we wore them slightly oversized, right? The like trying to be associated with those brands, that level of like Americana and leisure and wealth. The other was the, to DeRay's point, like the early aughts trend, like I'm thinking Kanye West and his Louis Vuitton backpack era, right? Also like sort of a connection to luxury and respectability. I definitely had a J. Crew and Sperry boat shoes phase, you know what I mean? Like in the early
aughts. Come on, J. Crew.
I 100% was spending my money in J. Crew all the time. And, you know, as somebody who clubbed, right, like to DeRay's point, I was wearing the same pants to the club as I was wearing to work as a high school teacher because clubs literally wouldn't let us in otherwise, you know. I also want to take this opportunity to go on the record against Diesel, the footwear designer, because they have these shoes in like 2003 to 2005 that I absolutely hated. And every man and mask person wore them to the club. And I just want to tell you, they were terrible shoes. If you still have them in your closet, that they're never coming back, throw them away. But the quarter zip thing.
Did you have jellies, Sharonda?
As a kid, yeah, for sure.
Shout out to the jellies.
In the other thing about this quarter zip thing, I think, Miles, to your point about the recession, right, is it's also interesting that it's coming up in this moment where we're seeing wealthy white people adopt what people have started calling quiet luxury, right? Which is like not outward name brands, not big logos, just like a if you know, you know thing. And the quarter zip movement seems to be kind of mimicking some of that too, right? Which is the like, your quarter zip is never going to have a big logo on it. The question now is going to be, how do I know that your quarter zip is a nice one or an expensive one versus like one you got at Burlington Coat Factory, you know?
and creating binary between, because a lot of it's like, oh, I'm not a Nike tech person, I'm a quarter zip person. So creating this kind of like binary inside the Black community. Remember earlier this year, we already saw the Ralph Lauren as that like kind of romanticized these kind of like Black elites who go to Martha Vineyard and who don't have the problems of white supremacy on their minds and who have figured out how to transcend those things and not get fat. And I think it's also a name because I think the pop feminism moment so took the non-respectable, don't be respectable thing to such to me it feels a little extreme. Goodbye, maybe I'm just old, but I'm just like, it feels a little extreme. So you kind of can feel that swing back. The last example I want to give too is my favorite one, is that Cheryl Lynn, who made Encore, you know, the singer Cheryl Lynn. Okay.
So
come
good.
On.
Okay. Deserves an encore. Y'all can't see my weave, but it was made for that song.
If y'all can see this wig, girl, this wig has a name, baby.
So good. So good. So that album that came out during the Reagan era was called Preppy. And people don't quite remember that part of
Turned
her
up collar.
Yeah, a part of her whole brand was being seen as preppy. So again, this is all cycle and trends, but we seem to see a pattern of when Black people want to button it up, and it's usually when the state buttons up.
My news is actually about Supermax prisons, sort of, but really about death row. So as you know, this is a big schism between left and right. The left doesn't generally believe in the death penalty. The right does. And even the people on the left who don't believe in the death penalty aren't defending the crimes that led to a death sentence, but are highlighting that Black people are disproportionately convicted incorrectly and sentenced to death. Also, this is not my news, but just reminding people that somebody just got killed in a state death row by a firing squad. All of it is inhumane, but the fact that we still have a state that has a firing squad that like straps people to a chair and shoots them is just crazy. Like that's happening. It is real. It just happened not even a month ago. Because Trump has publicly called for not only bringing back the death penalty, but people convicted of drug crimes to sentence them to death. That was a campaign proposal. What Biden did was he commuted all of the death sentence federal cases. So a commutation means that they now will serve life, but they will not get the death penalty. He commuted their sentences. They will not get the death penalty. So they would just stay wherever they were in prison. But Trump said, you know what? That's not good enough. You will now go to the most secure facility we have in the country. Whether you're a threat to anybody or not, you are going there. And this facility is in Colorado. It is called the United States Penitentiary Florence Administrative Maximum Facility, better known as ADX, and it has been named the Alcatrex of the Rockies. And in this place, the people incarcerated spend 22 to 24 hours locked every day inside concrete cells that are smaller than a standard parking space. There is almost no contact with other people. There's almost no programming. And if there is programming, it is broadcast over TVs that are in the cells. You essentially get no belongings. You can't hang photographs or drawings on the wall. Every time that you're out of a cell for exercise, you can only walk a few paces in each direction. The people are given virtual reality goggles to simulate outdoors. A former warden called ADX a, quote, clean version of hell. That, quote, was far much worse than death. I say this to say that there is no reason why the Bureau of Prisons should be placing people here. There is a law that says that they should be placed within 500 miles of their home. But Trump and his team have been like, screw that law, and they're just doing whatever they want. So they are now going to ADX. And it just is another way. A, it is wild because why do we even have a facility that is like this? It is also, they got commuted. They should be able to stay where they are. If they, you know, they should be able to stay where they are. And then the third is, you know, Trump has just done this full frontal assault on just the rule of law. Like the law says one thing, his team's like, we'll do whatever you want. You'll spend 20 years litigating it. And then by then the people will be dead, right? Like he just is sort of like, what does it mean? and for the constitutionalists, the da da da, all the people who are like, well, the rule of law, rule of law. It's like, it's not, y'all don't really believe in the rule of law when it says something that you don't believe in. And I do wish that our side was a little more gangster about violating all the laws when it could help people or stuff like that. If we're going to pick and choose, let's just pick and choose and be real crazy with everybody. But I brought this here because this is something that I hadn't seen anybody talk about. I didn't even remember that Biden commuted the death row people's sentences. And I didn't know that of all the million things Trump has done, I didn't know that Trump had done this.
I certainly didn't know what he had done either. And I've told you all that I am someone who consumes a lot of true crime content. I'm still working on that. But part of the reason I sort of even knew the name of the prison was because my understanding was that it was like reserved for like the worst of the worst, right? And obviously, like moving this group of people there signals to your point, right, that this is about excessive punishment, even as I'm like working to actually truly and more meaningfully embrace my emerging abolitionist politic. And I think what's interesting to me here is I'm starting to question, like, if I think there's anything anyone can do to deserve a life like that, you know? And I know that we don't think that these people are capable of being, you know, rehabilitated. There's no plan in most of these instances, given the length of their sentences and the crimes for which they were convicted, that they will ever, you know, see the light of day again. But it just feels like there's got to be a better way to do this than this. You know what I mean? And some of it also seems like who ends up here is about which cases got kind of the most media spotlight to, right? So it's like also about like proving a point when you're like, you know, y'all got mobsters here, right? And not to, again, no one is defending the crimes, right? But we are saying like a lot of this is about trying to perform that you are tough on crime.
So this is an interesting thing to be talking about today. But I was just watching the Breonna Joy podcast. She was interviewing Matt Stoller and Alec Caricatanis. I know I didn't say his name right, but I apologize. But they were talking about defund the police. And inside of that conversation, which was one of the reasons why I wanted to watch it, because inside of that conversation, they were also talking about prison abolition. And they were talking about, of course, one person was saying how like defund the police was like stupid and it was bad messaging. Other person was saying that, you know, prison abolition is more than like this kind of like logo and motto. And as I was like watching all three of them debate around this, it means kind of knowing clearly that like in our hearts, we need to like fight for a society with like without prison and without police. And like, even if that's not something that we will ever see in our lifetimes, hear these stories and get kind of reminded about how much we love the theater of other people's torture and love knowing about other people's torture, that Trump is not just doing this because he truly cares that bad people get bad punishments. It's not truly even about that. It's really because there is a thirst and there is an appetite for people to get punished in brutal ways or in ways that are, you know, sociopathic or ways that create sociopaths and psychopaths, or if you already are that, it only makes it worse. And I get scared, in air quotes, because I think a lot of the public disagrees. And that to me is what always is chilling, is that as much as there are people who think this shouldn't happen, da 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 da, there's so many people who think this is exactly what should happen, who are warmed by this happening. And I don't know necessarily how you penetrate those type of ideals around another human life, specifically where that person has done something heinous, you know? That's all I got for this story.
Yeah, but like we have a former Mexican government official who is there because he supposedly took money from a cartel, right, to protect shipments of drugs into the United States. And that is being punished in the same way as someone who tried to blow up a subway. You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm struggling because I do feel differently about someone who like smuggled drugs versus someone who tried to blow up a subway. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know.
I think under white supremacy, any affront to white life is good enough to get punished.
Punishable by death.
Absolutely. So I think that if you are giving us fentanyl and you're the reason why Meemaw is crying at the funeral, I'm being so anti-white. But if you're the reason why Mima is crying at the funeral, you deserve it. And if you're somebody who blew up a subway, you deserve it. And I think that is a part of white nationalism and white supremacy totally being absorbed into our politics. So it's not really about these details and these minutiae and this scenario and this scenario and this scenario. It is, if you are doing something to offend or to destroy this white male personhood, you deserve to be punished. And we don't care how you got there. We don't care what you did. We don't care if it was soft or hard, how you did it. You deserve to get punished. And I think that is the new normal, at least in ideas, that they're trying to spread. Because I think the morals, if you listen to the right, they're trying to get away from morals. They're trying to get away from you being able to call me a bad person. They're like, we don't care. That's what they really want to say, even about Israel. They want to say that we do not care about these brown kids getting blown up. We need this oil. We need this friend in the Middle East, and we'll do whatever we got to do about it. And you can't guilt us out of destroying these people. That's not a good enough reason to stop this warfare. And I think that this feels like an extension of that. It's kind of like a little bit of a Minority Report soft launch. Like, no, so many things should be punishable underneath death to them and brutality to them.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. And don't forget to follow us at Pod Save the People and Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by Adrian Moultrie and mixed by Charlotte Landis. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Miles E. Johnson and Sharon DeBossier. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.